Hello everyone, my name is Chloe and welcome to a new season of The Burning Case, a place for critical conversations about our future on this planet and how policy making, but also radical democracy, are essential to make sure that future is not only green, but also fair and inclusive. We'll be chatting about the burning issues of our time, how policies are made, and give you the tools to overhaul the system. Let's get started. Hello, it's been a while and we're sorry about this, but let's just say the past 2 weeks have been a bit hectic, and as you know, this is an all volunteer-led podcast, so sometimes episodes do take a little bit more time to get produced and released. But we're back today with a super interesting conversation on something we all use every day, plastics. You might be thinking, but wasn't plastics the hot thing a few years ago, but we made progress about it since? Not really. While researching the episode, the stats and numbers we came across were staggering. Some examples: 40% of plastic produced is packaging, used just once and then discarded. Nearly half of all plastics ever manufactured has been made since 2000. 8 million pieces of plastic pollution make their way into the ocean every day. Joyful, right? But do you know that plastics isn't just a pollution and health issue? It's also very much a climate problem. Indeed, 90% of plastics is made from fossil fuels, and about 8% of the world's oil production is used to make plastics and power the manufacturing of it. But that figure is actually projected to rise to 20% by 2050. Why? Because plastics is essentially the next frontier for the fossil fuel industry. But before we dive into this, what progress have been made to tackle plastic pollution, and what we can do to prevent this master evil collaboration between plastics and the fossil fuel industries, which sounds so bad, here's Melissa with some hot news of the day.
Hi everyone. Today I'm briefly going to talk about the Nature Restoration Law. And well, wasn't that an emotional roller coaster? But thankfully, it does end in a positive-ish way, with lawmakers in the European Parliament voting in favour of the law last Wednesday, so Wednesday 12th of July, after defeating a right-wing attempt to reject it. And oh my, did we see some shady fighting, with the EPP leading the path for disinformation, consumer guilt, blatant lies, and whatnot. Thankfully, some MEPs, and more importantly, fantastic activists, do have nature's back, and we're able to lead a beautiful and powerful campaign to stop right and far right from bullying. So what is the Nature Restoration Law? The law will oblige all EU countries to take better care of the EU's network of priority habitats and make efforts to return these habitats to good condition. Countries will have to meet specific targets set for 2030, 2040, and 2050 to improve and expand them over time. Unfortunately, in order to reach a compromise, MEPs did have to sacrifice many critical obligations and targets, ending up with a position substantially weaker than the original Commission's proposal. Nevertheless, it is a win, and it does vouch for the power of people-led campaigns. So, yay to that. And back to Chloe with today's episode.
Thanks, Melissa. And to discuss this, we are here today with Delphine Levy-Alvarez, who is the Break Free from Plastic Global Petrochemical Campaign Coordinator, currently working with the Center for International Environmental Law. You may know it as CIEL. Thank you so much, Delphine. How are you doing today?
I'm very good, Chloe. Thank you. I'm super happy to be on the podcast that I always listen with a lot of
Thank you.
Joy.
That's very kind. Oh, we love it when our guests listen to our episodes. My first question of the day, so if you've listened to it before, you know that's the question we ask all of our guests, is what is your coffee order?
My coffee order is cappuccino with oatmeal.
Oh,
and after 2 p.m., it has to be decaf. Otherwise,
yep,
I don't
feel
sleep.
You. But it's mine too. Cappuccino with oat milk. Simple, but very effective for the win. Okay, so let's dive in. Let's actually take a step back to begin. We are in 2016, 2017. Everyone has seen that photo of the turtle with the straw, right? And there's a big global conversation about plastic and plastic pollution. It's everywhere in the media. There's a rise in zero waste blogger. Everyone is talking about plastic pollution. now we are 6-7 years later and it is much less present, or at least it feels that way. Can you explain why? What's happened? Why are we not talking about it anymore?
So I think we're still really much talking about it, but we have deepened our understanding of the issue and started connecting it with a lot of other environmental and social fights, meaning that we do talk about it a lot, but more in conjunction with other things. So you have a lot of conversations around chemicals in plastic that end up in like food, for example, or water. You have the microplastics discussion that has really boomed in the last few years. You have the health impact discussion around what plastic in the environment, in our body, is doing. And you have this much awaited conversation that's starting on how that connects to the fossil fuel and climate crisis issue. So it is still very much discussed, but not in a general sense, and with more complexity than ever, meaning that for a less maybe accustomed eye, it may seem like it's less present, but I personally, I don't think it is. But I'm appreciating that we're talking about it with more complexity and in conjunction.
So we're moving away from the more, let's say, lifestyle consumption of plastic to move more into more complex discussion, as you said. But have we made any progress? Because I was actually at the supermarket this morning, very randomly, and I knew we were recording today, and I was looking around and I was like, well, there's still as much plastic as there used to be. It doesn't feel like there's less. And there's a rise in, maybe we'll talk about it later, but there's a rise in synthetic materials in fashion. So it still feels like plastic is very much part of our lives. So can you maybe give us a quick overview of what's the situation? Has it improved in the past few years? But also, have there been good efforts to regulate plastic according to you? Or have there been any efforts at all? Actually, let's take a step back.
Yeah, plastic is still pretty much everywhere in our life. The research around where it is also in the environment has dramatically increased in the last 7 years. And we know now that it's in the most remote places, deserted islands, the deepest ocean grounds, highest mountains. You find it in your blood, in sperm, in food and drinking water and bottled water as well. So it's pretty much everywhere. And indeed, if you look around, you don't feel like there has been any progress. If you look at production, it hasn't slowed down and it's still planned to double by 2050. We do have some progresses in terms of legislation to tackle plastic pollution. It's still quite insufficient. Amongst some of the first and sort of pioneer legislation, you have African countries like Rwanda, who banned single-use plastic bags already in 2008. And it took another 11 years to have a landmark legislation at the EU level. So they were very much in advance compared to the European Union. And we have banned a series of plastic items, the most commonly found on the shores of oceans and seas, and imposed some producer responsibility schemes, meaning that asking the producers to pay a fee per ton of product of packaging and products they put on the market to cover for the waste management costs of these products at the end of their life. It's just a foot in the door because it's regulating the 10 items the most commonly found in the environment in the EU, and there is much more. And as you're rightfully pointing, whatever doesn't go to these products in terms of plastic production has found new markets, because it's plastic is not a demand driven issue. You don't have plastic because you need plastic. You have plastic because there is a supply, and this supply, we'll come back to that, is directly connected to the economics of the fossil fuel sector. And whatever doesn't go to packaging can go very quickly to textile. Whatever doesn't go to textile can somewhat go to pesticides and fertilizers. So there's like a waterbed effect. You push somewhere, it goes up some, you push down somewhere, it goes up somewhere else. That is very obvious with plastic when you actually start looking.
Yeah, and actually, while you mentioned that, I think it's a very interesting link to my following question, which is on the plastics treaty, right? So I don't know if many people know actually that there were these negotiations happening, because I didn't really see it in the media. I saw it by following your accounts and other people that I follow on Twitter's account who were there, but it wasn't widely reported. So in case you didn't know, in late May, delegates from 118 nations came to Paris to begin essentially discussion or to lay out the first treaty to control plastic production and waste. So my first question is actually, was there hope that this would be the Paris Agreement moment that we had for climate for plastic? And as a follow-up question, it seemed like clearly there were different demands and expectations from civil society and the industry, right? Because obviously, we as civil society, we want plastic to be regulated at the source. So we want to turn off the tap on plastic so that there's less plastic being produced in the first place. Whereas the industry wants to focus on end-of-life solutions, so not necessarily reducing the quantity of plastics, but really focusing on the recycling and what we do with the plastic to avoid it ending up in weird places. So you were there, right? You were.
Was it
a Paris Agreement moment for plastics? And maybe can you tell us a little bit about the content of the negotiations and the outcome?
Sure. I think it's interesting to rewind a little bit. So the meeting that was held in Paris end of May, early June, was a second round of negotiations of this global agreement. And the first round took place in Uruguay last year in November. What's interesting with this process is that it started within the United Nations Environment Assembly process that most people do not know much about. It's a fairly recent institution or place for negotiations. And it started as a series of resolutions that were initially focusing on marine litter and microplastics. So very much end of life, end of pipe, plastic in the environment focus. And I joined the process in 2017, so it was UNEA 3. And between 2017 and 2022, when we got the resolution that adopted the mandate for an intergovernmental negotiating committee to start discussing this treaty, this global agreement, there was a massive evolution in the scope of the treaty. We ended up with a mandate that talks about plastic pollution, including in the marine environment, but not limited to it. We're talking about a treaty that needs to address the full life cycle of plastic, so also the production of plastic. And we got a mandate to negotiate a global legally binding treaty.
Oh, interesting. So whatever comes out of this process would have to be legally binding for... Okay, but that's a follow-up question, because so would it be legally binding for the countries that are discussing this? So meaning they would have to implement measures to tackle plastic. Would these measures then... How does it work with the companies, right? Because it's not the plastics treaty that's going to make the plastic industry change. It's going to have to go through countries, right?
Yeah. So the treaty will be legally binding for whoever ratifies it. And this is the game, right? In these international negotiations, you have a lot of countries that are here to delay getting into substantial conversations and to water down the ambition of the agreement. Even if they perfectly know that they will never ratify the treaty, they will never sign on to such an agreement. So they're here to make sure that whatever others end up ratifying is not going to limit them and their commercial interests. So some of the countries that we've seen working really hard within the space to make it as slow and unambitious as possible. Like, so Saudi Arabia and other petrostates. It's interesting to also understand that these countries were not part of the discussion at the stage of the resolution. And basically, they started understanding what was at stake with this treaty when the resolution was adopted. So we had a massive wave of new country participating in the INCs compared to the UNEA process that was at the end especially pretty friendly, and the same group of countries who had worked together for over 5 years on this issue. Why they are here and interested is pretty clear. Plastic is one of the escape patches of the fossil fuel industry. And the countries whose economy rely on fossil fuel extraction and transformation have a direct interest in making sure we do not limit production of plastic. Because what the treaty could do for the companies, to come back to your question, the treaty could impose a cap on plastic production that would have to be accompanied with implementation measures for countries. And that could be, plans with the industry, that could be restriction and stricter conditions when it comes to granting permits for new installation or stricter emission standards so that old facilities would not comply anymore and would have to be decommissioned. There are a series of implementation measures that needs to be taken into consideration. It won't apply directly to companies. It will through country policies and global objectives. Yeah. And one thing about your Paris Agreement question, it was when the resolution was adopted last year, it was said in the press that it was the most historical environmental moment after the Paris Agreement or at the level of the Paris. We are precisely trying to get a treaty that doesn't look like UNFCCC and the Paris Agreement by making sure that we address the source of the problem rather than the symptoms, meaning we're not looking at limiting leakage that you can consider like emissions of plastic into the environment, like you would address emissions of greenhouse gases in UNFCCC. We are looking at limiting what creates this problem. So production of plastic, design, waste management. So everything sort of upstream. So really looking at the sources rather than at the symptom.
And how's that going? Can you give, because obviously we didn't have that moment and there's going to be another meeting in November. So if you had to explain very simply what was the outcome of that meeting and what you expect from the meeting in November?
So the outcome of the meeting was that we have a mandate for the chair of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee, INC, and the secretariat of the process to develop a zero draft for this treaty. So what we discussed during the second round of negotiations was not based on any text. It was just based on an options for elements paper that UNEP published before the negotiations. That was itself based on the submissions from country delegations and observers. That just was like a long list of options and to regulate plastic. It's not amazing, but it's already good that we have this mandate because it means that for INC 3 in November, we are going to be able to discuss on the basis of something tangible.
Yeah.
Meaning that we're going to start having a lot of fun with.
So good. Okay. So the process is essentially, just to make sure everybody understands, so the process is kickstarted and now you guys are going to start discussing sort of more of the content based on the text and start negotiating.
Yes.
I want to go back to something that's is one of my favorite thing in the world, conflict of interest and the role of the industry lobbying in these processes. So at this meeting in Paris, there were about 190 representatives from plastic and petrochemical industries, which was extremely concerning. And it's not the first time. There was already suspicion about industry's influence on UNEP, so the UN Environmental Agency, when it published the solutions report, which you mentioned. So there was a consultancy firm called Systemic, with a Q at the end, which helped draft the reports. And that company also consults for the plastic industry, which could be considered and should be considered as a big conflict of interest. So do you feel this very heavy presence and this very heavy lobbying by the industry in these discussions? And if that's the case, what can we do about it? Can we implement a conflict of interest policy that kicks out the plastic industry and the fossil fuel industry out of these processes?
Yes, we feel it in different ways and forms. We do not know exactly how many lobbies were present in the negotiations. We know that about 190 were registered. And we just got yesterday the list of participants who effectively picked up their badge. So now we have a little bit of homework to do to compare that and know who was there. What was interesting is that it was not an obvious presence in the sense that some of them were through country delegations. Some of them were through intergovernmental organizations, like the ones that represent oil and gas exporting countries. Some of them were through think tanks, others trade associations, because most of them cannot be registered as such as their organization. So it was a bit of a research game to look into who is who and who actually works for who and understand that. We have been, prior to INC2, already raising that with Greenpeace, members of Break Free from Plastic, and over 150 civil society organizations and scientists to UNEP to ask to limit their influence. The challenge we have is to limit their influence. It's a little bit like within the UNFCCC, right? We won't limit the influence of the countries that are lobbying on fossil fuel. The most effective lobbyists in that context are country delegates themselves, the ones who are, you know, benefiting from that fossil economy, like all the petrostates. But surely we could limit the influence. And yesterday there was a very important decision made within the Aarhus Convention that says that the countries party to this convention are going to commit to limit the influence of industry in international negotiations, meaning that the 46 countries that have signed on need to actively take action in that matter in the plastics treaty space, but other spaces like UNFCCC.
So I want to go back to something that you said, Inish, like a little bit before, that plastics is now sort of the escape route for the fossil fuel industry. And of course, I think we can both agree that things are not moving fast enough on the energy transition front, but at the same time, they're moving. And a lot of them are sort of starting to feel a little bit the heat, right? And so that's why they're really turning to petrochemicals and plastic in particular as their major growth markets. So for instance, Judith Eng, who's the founder and president of Beyond Plastics, said plastics is the plan B for the fossil fuel industry. And a great example is one of my favorite companies in the world, so Total Energy, who before Christmas announced a partnership with the biggest oil and gas company in the world that very few people know, called Saudi Aramco, which is the Saudi Arabia national company. They agreed, and they're having a little bit of a partnership to build a new petrochemical complex in Saudi Arabia, with the goal to produce 1 million tons of polyethylene, I think that's how you say it in English, per year, which is a very common type of plastics that you find in many, many different products, such as, you know, wrapping and bottles and cables, etc. So, first of all, can you confirm that plastics is the new frontier for the fossil fuel industry? And if so, what is it going to look like?
So it is. It's not even the plan B. I think at this stage it's the plan A. what is it going to look like? What is already looking like is that investments are massively going into converting or repurposing refineries to produce different kind of outputs that could be used in petrochemicals production. Same for gas processing plants. That means continuing extraction on the back of petrochemicals production. And it also means that on the coal issue, whatever we're not extracting for energy purpose is a potential for feedstock for petrochemicals, because you can also make petrochemicals out of coal as feedstock, not as energy source. There are many different ways in which we are seeing this diversion of fossil fuel feedstock from energy and transport to petrochemicals. What it means is that we need to address that as a common issue. We need to look at supply and demand together, because, as I said, what doesn't go to energy and transport goes to petrochemicals. Within the petrochemical sector, what doesn't go to one sector goes to the other one. What it means essentially is that we don't have extremely recent data, because there is a very clear lack of transparency when it comes to the petrochemicals industry sector.
Surprising.
Surprising. But it means that by 2050, it could be 20% of the oil consumption.
Wow.
And I would say about the same for gas. If you look at the European Union, for example, petrochemicals production is already 14% of gas consumption and 15% of oil consumption, and plastic will be about half of it. So it is already ahead of aviation, ahead of shipping, ahead of automotive production, the most fossil fuel intensive industrial sector. And it's a sector that completely goes under the radar. And already back in 2018, the International Energy Agency and director was warning that while our economies are strongly dependent on petrochemicals, that's a quote, petrochemicals products, the sector was under a lot less scrutiny than it should, making the petrochemicals industry one of the dead angles of the global energy debate. We haven't still been discussing it much, and it's been 5 years.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, I mean, it's another reason to phase out the fossil fuel industry completely, right? So I've got two remaining questions. The first one then is, in terms of policy and regulation, what's your biggest hope? Is it, and what should we do? Is it the plastics treaty at the global level and the UN process? Is it to phase out the fossil fuel industry completely, to nationalize / socialize the fossil fuel industry so that we can actually control their investments? What do you think would be the most effective thing to do in the next few years? Because we know we have a very soon coming deadline.
Yeah, I think we have a great opportunity with the plastics treaty discussion. At the same time, a colleague and friend who started working on that before people were thinking about it, Neil Simon, said that we haven't solved any environmental issue with a treaty, but we also haven't solved any environmental issues without a treaty. So I think this is the opportunity to talk about action globally, but it will have to be translated into action nationally. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's just looking at plastic. And yeah. So if we don't have very strong measures on fossil fuel extraction and trade, we are also not going to solve the overall climate crisis. So as I said, we need policies on supply as much as on the demand side of fossil fuel. I'm having hopes with legislations like the EU methane regulation, for example, because petrochemicals was included in the scope, and they're still hopefully looking at having a supply chain approach, meaning imposing similar legislation or restrictions to countries that would want to import or export to the EU, meaning that this could have an impact on how plastics and petrochemicals are produced outside, because we do still have most of the plastic we consume and a lot of the petrochemicals we consume coming from outside. Outside the EU. So it's a global sort of comprehensive answer that we need.
Yeah. And a final question, because it's, I think, very important to also bring it down to what people can do. So on this topic for a very long time, the main recommendations to people was to reduce their plastic consumption, right? So go to zero waste supermarket and reduce the plastic that you buy in bulk, etc. But if we take it to the more systemic policy level, which we have been discussing in this episode, what can people do? Because, I mean, a lot of the things you mentioned are super important, but it's UN processes, it's e-regulations where a lot of people can't really make their voices heard. So is there something concrete that people can do to tackle this still ongoing problem of plastic pollution that doesn't involve their lifestyle habits?
There are many things to do, and I'm happy you're asking this question because I'm really tired of hearing that people need to, you know, go around with their reusable cup to solve plastic pollution. I still encourage people to do that, but it's not really on individual citizens to solve an issue that was created by the system. I think in terms of concrete action, I would encourage people to look at the money. We have a lot of production because there is a lot of money flowing to production. And while it's often private capitals, it's massively supported and guaranteed by public finance. I would encourage them to ask questions to their banks. There has been amazing campaigning on exposing the responsibility of banks, not only commercial banks, but also banks for, you know, people.
Yeah.
In fossil fuel extraction, in petrochemicals production projects. And there is a lot of resource out there to know if your bank is part of the problem, mm-hmm. and to challenge them on that and potentially put your money somewhere else. Challenging your government, if you're in a country where you have pension funds and this kind of systems, also checking where is the money being used, and what for. Because if you withdraw the money from these projects, they just don't happen.
Yeah. Typically the petrochemical complex that we were just discussing between Total and Saudi Aramco. Okay, that's a really good tip. Follow the money, ask questions. We'll try to put some resources in the description of the episode. Thank you so much, Delphine. It was a pleasure to hear from you on this topic, and keep on the good fight.
Thank you, Chloe.
And that's it for today's episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. And if you would like to support the podcast, click follow on Spotify or Apple Music. It will help others find us. Also, if you find our content interesting, don't hesitate to share it on social media or in the old-fashioned way by talking about us to your friends and community. We hope you'll be back for the next episode. And in the meantime, have a great day. Bye.